Tokyo Podcast Episode Number 15.
Hey everybody, on today's show I go hands-on with the new Sony PlayStation Vita. We go exploring Japanese castles and I briefly talk about my holiday plans for the year. Hey everybody, welcome to Tokyo Podcast episode number 15. I am your host, Anthony Joe, and I got a lot to cover in today's show, actually. First, I wanted to mention that today is actually going to be the last show of 2011. That's right, this is the final show. There will not be a show next week, or as a matter of fact, the first week in January. Now, why is that? It's because I am heading to Thailand for my winter break. I'm heading back to Thailand to mostly just to actually pick up the rest of my stuff. When I tried to move here originally, I had so much stuff to carry with me that the airline wouldn't allow me to bring it on. So I need to go back to Thailand, see some friends, and pick up the rest of my stuff. While I'm there, I will actually also be doing a special episode of Bangkok Podcast with my co-host Greg Jorgensen. We're going to be talking about comparing living in Bangkok versus living in Japan, as well as an update on the flooding situation in Bangkok. We had a friend of ours whose house was flooded out, so he's going to come on the show and talk about what that experience was like. So if you're interested in following me to Thailand and checking out what the Bangkok Podcast is like, do a search for bangkokpodcast.com and listen for the new show coming out next week. So I'll be in Thailand for a couple weeks enjoying the nice 30 degree temperature while all of you in Tokyo are freezing cold. Man, was it ever cold today. Good Lord, I was cold. But I will be back on the air on January 8th. And I am really excited about what I've got lined up for January, actually. To give you a quick preview, a hint, I recently talked to a gentleman who spent 2 years photographing the Japanese Yakuza. Yeah, get that. He, of all the things to photograph in Japan, this guy decided that he wanted to try and photograph the Yakuza, and surprisingly, they said yes. So he spent 2 years photographing a Yakuza group here in Tokyo, and it is really interesting to hear his take on what that experience was like. He was granted pretty much unregulated access to the Yakuza, and one of the things that was interesting he said to me was that after the negotiations took almost a year, and after the negotiations were finished and they'd given the okay, it took another 6 months for him to go through proper etiquette training so he didn't accidentally, you know, piss off some godfather or anything like that. He had to go through the training on how to act around the Yakuza, and not specifically because they're a Yakuza per se, but just how to act around them because they're Japanese. He said that the Yakuza are very kind of traditional Japanese. So, you know, and if you're Gaijin listening to this, you know what I'm talking about, because many times in Japan, you've got to be on your like best behavior. And apparently when you're around the Yakuza, that's always the case. So he had to go through like this training. And then not only that, but they said, give us like a few months because we have to send the word down to all the Yakuza members that you're going to be photographing us, so that some of them don't accidentally freak out and kill you or anything like that. So the word came down from the godfather and everything was okay. But a fascinating account of what it was like to join up with the Yakuza for a few years. I'll also be talking to a lady named Sachi, and she just recently completed an epic bike ride from Okinawa to Hokkaido. She decided, and what's amazing about Sachi is that she didn't have a background in sports, or she's not a triathlete or anything like that. She decided that she wanted to sample the various cuisine that is available through Japan. And what's interesting about Japan is, and different areas are known for their different types of food. So she decided that she wanted to try all these different kinds of food. And what a better way to work off all those excess calories than to cycle between destinations. So she decided to cycle from Okinawa to Hokkaido, and she recently completed her bicycle journey. So she's going to be coming on the show and talking about what that experience was like. I'm actually very interested about this because it's something that I've thought about doing as well. I've kind of debated on whether I'm going to do it on a bicycle or a motorcycle. I know a bicycle, you kind of have a little bit more interaction, but I kind of like the speed of a motorcycle. But after talking to her, I'm really eager to kind of hop on the bike and experience that myself. So I've got some really great shows lined up for January. I hope everyone can tune in, and I will be back on the air on January 8th. Else I wanted to quickly mention and is today I had the opportunity to go see the launch of the new Sony PlayStation Vita. This is Sony's new portable gaming device designed to replace their PlayStation Portable, and I was contacted by an Italian gaming magazine who asked me to do some video work for them because I do some freelance video work on the side, and so they wanted me to come down to the launch and film it, and I got to see that. And I wanted to kind of give you my thoughts on what I thought about the new Sony PlayStation Vita. I know in North America it's not coming out till February, so if you're in North America and you're kind of eager to find out about it, I just want to give you my quick thoughts on what I saw. I should say, though, that I am probably not the best person to review this item. I am a gadget geek. I do like gadgets, but I've never really used a Sony PlayStation Portable that much, and I also tend to be a bit biased towards Apple products. So keep that in mind when I give you this review. One of the first things I noticed, well, let me talk about the launch for one. This device is supposed to help Sony kind of recover a little bit from the massive losses that they're incurring in almost every other division of their company. I recently read that Sony has lost $8 billion, $8 billion over the last 8 years in their television industry. Now they actually make more money from their financial services, such as insurance and whatnot, than they do from selling products. So this is supposed to design to kind of offset some of those losses. So you would think that Sony would be very excited about this device and would have a big fanfare and a big launch and invite all the press and want to make a big deal about it. And apparently that's not the case. What it was they invited a bunch of journalists to come here on your dime, and they had the opening at this little music video game store in Shibuya under that Starbucks. If you've been to Shibuya, you know that Starbucks by that crossing, just under there's kind of a video game music store, and that's where they had the launch of this device. And I was really surprised because, you know, a couple of things surprised me is that, one, they scheduled the press conference at like 7 in the morning. And why? Why would they schedule it so early? And when we got there, there was maybe a dozen or maybe a bit more, maybe 20 at the most, 30 maybe at the most, I think about 20 people waiting outside for this, fans waiting outside for this device. I heard there were more at other locations, but this is the one with the big launch. This is the one where all the executives are coming, so you kind of think that this would be the one where all the fans would show up. But honestly, I think the press outnumbered the fans about 2-1. So why in heaven's name they decided to launch this so early in the morning, I have no idea. You would think that they would kind of wait till later on in the day, you know, like Apple does, so that more fans could be waiting outside. It doesn't look good when you have the world's press standing there and the lineup for this thing is like 12 people deep. So I was a little bit surprised at that. Anyways, everybody crowds into this room. Like I said, like the room is packed with basically press because there's hardly any fans. And they have this little tiny stage area set up. And I mean, if you've seen kind of the Apple demonstrations and the keynotes, I mean, they're huge, right? They rent the huge theater, and it is such a well-produced production that this one by Sony really left me really disappointed. I was really kind of surprised at how kind of rinky-dink and how lame, honestly, it was. You know, they had this little tiny stage set up, and then two executives, I don't remember their names, came out. I believe one of them was head of Sony Gaming or something like that, came out and basically briefly talked about the device and took some photos, and that's about it. You know, there was no demonstration. There was a little kind of promo video that they showed, but there was no actual demonstration of the unit at all. Now, if you compare that to, you know, some of the Apple keynotes where Steve Jobs always demonstrates the product, you know, even if you go back a few years to like when he was demonstrating, say, the iPod Touch, he would always show off some new features and then demonstrate it to get the audience excited about what the potential is for this item. You're like, hey, I want to go try that. But this wasn't the case at all. They just, you know, talked about some of the features of it. And that's it. It was a very dry, almost like a Microsoft-style business presentation. And then they invited like the world's biggest otaku on stage to be the first one. I guess he was the first one in line or the first one to buy it or something like that. And I mean, no disrespect to this guy, but he was clearly out of his element. The executives were trying to make this a happy moment. He was really, he looked really uncomfortable. Halfway during the kind of speech by the president, this guy, this otaku guy, whips out his camera and tries to start taking photographs of the media and everything, which was a little bit awkward. He actually handed the PlayStation Vita to the president. You know, can you hold this while I take pictures? And so the whole thing was really kind of uncomfortable. And then the executives went off stage and they allowed like the 12 people in to buy these things. And that's about it. And even the press that I was with, we weren't given a press device at all. You know, even the Italian guy that I was working with, he had one reserved, but we had to wait in line for like half an hour, just like everybody else to pick up this unit. Which is quite surprising because usually, you know, a gadget company, a consumer electronic company would make these things available for the press. So I was a little bit underwhelmed with the launch, considering I guess I'm used to Apple launches where they, you know, they kind of make a bigger deal about it. Especially when you consider, though, that how much importance Sony places on this device. But anyways, we finally got our copy and then went back to the hotel room for the to film the unboxing. And the unit itself is quite nice looking. It has a nice solid feel to it. The first thing I did notice, though, that it's quite a bit larger than the old one, which I was kind of surprised at, because I guess I'm used to Apple's philosophy of making devices smaller and thinner. But Sony seems to be going the opposite way and making it larger and heavier. But having said that, it does have a nice feel to it. It feels a bit more solid, a little bit more professional feeling than the older one. All the joysticks and the touchpad and all that kind of stuff seem fairly responsive. We did have some issues, though, trying to activate it on the Sony PlayStation Network. It was a bit strange that I don't know if there's a bug in the OS or something, but when we tried to activate it, it didn't work. And then it asked us to download a software update. You know, the day it's released, it's asking us to download a software update. We downloaded that. Actually, there's a flaw in the navigation system where we couldn't even download the update for a while until we figured out how to work around it. So overall, I wasn't impressed with the OS at all. Now, having said that, I haven't used the Sony PlayStation Portable very much at all. So if you have and you picked this up, maybe the OS is a lot more familiar to you. But for myself and even this the Italian guy who, you know, works for a video game magazine and he deals with these things all the time, we had a lot of trouble figuring out the navigation in the device, figuring out how to quit games. And I noticed that at times when we were trying to use the browser on it, it was extremely laggy and stuttered a lot. So I was really kind of surprised at how kind of toy-like and I don't know what the word for it is, but it did not seem like a polished product. And I really hope that this isn't an indicator of the direction that Sony is going, because honestly, like, if you take a look at what Apple's doing, and not only Apple, but what Android's doing, the idea of carrying around this giant gaming machine where you have to put in games, like little, basically little tiny cartridges like you used to use for Nintendo, these little SD cards that you slide in to play a game. That seems a rather antiquated process when you consider the fact that you can buy an iPod Touch and download 100 games and keep them with you all the time. Now, and I know now that Sony does have that kind of digital download system, but all the games that we bought came on a chip. So if you want to play it, you have to put that card in the game, which I was really surprised at. So overall, I honestly wasn't impressed with this device at all. If you're a hardcore gamer, the graphics and all that did look actually pretty good, and the gameplay was very nice. But I really kind of question the future of these devices, especially with the sales of the Sony 3DS the Nintendo 3DS not doing too good. I really wonder what the future is for these hardware gaming devices. I suspect that the shift is starting in consumer market now, moving towards just mostly software and being able to download games to your iOS or your Android device. So I wonder what's the future for these things. Are people, I could kind of see them, you know, being popular in Japan where people spend a lot of time commuting. And if you are on the train, you don't want to run the battery down on your phone. Yeah, it's great to have a, you know, portable gaming device. But in places like America where we drive everywhere, do we really want to carry two things? I mean, this thing is twice the size of an iPod. So do we really want to carry something so large? And then also too, is you can't download games. You got to put this little, you know, the SD card in. It just seems like a rather old way of doing things. So I was really surprised that the whole thing. I mean, this is Sony. This is supposed to be one of the top electronic companies here in Japan, and here they've got this like kind of rinky-dink, almost sideshow-like presentation with just two executives just talking about it, and then that's it, and then they were done. They're done by like 7:30, and no hands-on, no display unit, no demo unit available, nothing. And then when we finally buy the unit and get it, The OS is confusing. The menu system is confusing. It's rather childlike too. I was really surprised at how childish the OS looks. It looks like something made by Nintendo more so than something made by Sony. Sony's OS usually has a little bit more polish, a little bit more professionalism to it. But this thing is a lot of cute animation and cute graphics and cute sounds, which I don't know if the old one was like that or not, but I wouldn't expect that from a Sony device. I would expect that from a Nintendo device, but not a Sony one. But I don't know. If you're into portable gaming, I think the specs on this thing are pretty good. The graphics look really great. But honestly, in my opinion, if you do want a portable gaming device, I would buy an iPod instead of the new Sony Vita. Today I'm talking to Mr. Daniel O'Grady, who runs a website called JapanCastleExplorer.com. And his site has been online for about 4 years now and explores the many Japanese castles that are scattered throughout Japan. And what's really interesting about his website is he has a very detailed map showing you the locations of all these castles around Japan. This map provides a ton of information if you are interested in Japanese castles, and I am extremely pleased to talk to him today. Welcome to the show.
Oh, g'day, Anthony. Thank you very much for that excellent introduction. Appreciated.
No worries. So tell me about your website. I myself love Japanese castles. I think they just look amazing. And so I was searching online one day and I came across your website and I was just blown away by the amount of detail that you've got on your site. How did you get started on this on your website?
Okay, well, I guess about four years ago, I just had two interests, computers, IT, and Japanese castles, and I had lots of free time, basically. And so in between traveling, you know, after work, come home, and I just had a real passion to bring these together and make a great site that was accessible by many, many people.
Now, how long have you been in Japan?
So I've been in Japan for 10 years, and I did a lot of castle exploring in my first year, actually, because I was a part-time teacher with Nova, right. The English conversation school that's, I'm unsure if they're still around. Right. But, you know, I had a, you know, part-time schedule and I was off traveling sort of every month, you know. Now that I'm sort of settled down with a family, it's a bit hard to find the time, but I do what I can.
Yeah, I'm really always surprised at how many castles that I kind of see around scattered even around Tokyo. You know, like it's not really castles per se, but it's little temples and shrines that you kind of find tucked away amongst skyscrapers and all this modern stuff. It's really, really interesting to see.
Yeah.
How did you get around? Was it easy to get around Japan to visit all these castles?
Yeah, I mean, my method, I guess, is to not plan. You know, I sort of pick a destination, and then I just sort of blindly go at it. You know, I don't know the routes, or I just jump on a train, get to where I'm going, or try to get to where I'm going. Ask people, you know, where you know, is it left or right? Or I think that's my way. You know, I just sort of keep headbutting my way around, and you know, and it's great to find stuff accidentally as well. You know.
Now you have a very detailed map on your website, and I love this map because I'm a details guy myself. So I just love this map. How many castles do you actually have on your map?
At the second, I guess there's about 140. But if I could just talk a bit about the number of castles in Japan,
sure.
The number of castles that there have been in Japan, and it's said that there are over 3,000.
Wow.
Now that could range from, you know, a very simple mountaintop fort, very, very small and like a stockade, and it, you know, all the way down to what we see in Nagoya and Osaka today, which is these massive stone-walled, huge compounds, you know, big towers. So the range from small to large is quite big. So over the centuries, there have been thousands of these castles.
So you're saying there's 3,000 left now, today?
Well,
or there were 3,000?
There are 3,000 plus that have existed.
Okay.
Now, what remains today, it could range from, as I said, the castles that we see in Osaka, etc.
Right.
All the way down to a simple signpost that says there once was a castle here.
Interesting.
So when I say there are 3,000 plus, you know, it's not actually 3,000 epic castles like that we imagine, yeah.
That's one of the things that fascinates me about Japan is you have this such unique links to the past. You know, a signpost here, a little shop here, a little temple here.
Yes.
That could be, you know, I've been sitting there for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And it's never been touched. It's always very interesting to me. Tell me, what is the history of these castles? Who actually owned these things? Is it similar to England where it was the lords and the nobles who built the castles?
Okay, well... Gee, how do I answer that? I guess, but with regard to the Edo period and the age of the samurai,
right?
So I guess, you know, the time preceding that someone found their way up and they became the lord of an area. But it's a bit hard to answer that because when there was the Sengoku period, everyone was fighting for themselves and everyone wanted to take another person's land.
Okay.
But during the shogunate, the Edo shogunate, Edo period, or the Kamakura period, I guess they owe their allegiance to that lord.
Right.
And that lord could, you know, take a castle, award the castle to someone else.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
Right, okay.
So either they're fighting for themselves in the period of chaos.
Right.
Or they're at the whim of the shogunate.
Who would take the castle and give it as a gift or something to
Or
a loyal subject or something like that.
Yeah, if in the Edo period if you found someone to marry without permission of the shogunate, then they could and they did take your castle and award it to someone else.
Wow.
Yes. So that actually did happen in the early 1600s. I don't have the details, but absolutely, that could happen.
Now, are there different styles of castles?
Oh, absolutely. I guess we'll just begin. I'll answer that just looking at castles from the 1500s, 1600s. So there's like a flatland castle, which is a castle in a plain. And this was pretty handy because it was near the castle town, near a town, near the center. And it could administer the lands quite easily. And a variation on this was a hilltop castle, which is a small hill. Much better defended, but again, probably near a town center. Hmm. On the other extreme, you've got a mountain castle, quite inaccessible, difficult for them to administer the area from that, you know, inconvenient location. So as time progressed, they would come down to the plains and hilltops.
Right. And these castles, typically, how many people do you think would be living inside of them?
Oh, The garrison. I mean, I'm really not up on the garrisons, but I mean, yeah, it's, you know, thousands is reasonable to assume.
Thousands, eh? Wow.
Yeah. With regards to, I guess some people have the image that people lived in castles, you know, like the tower.
Right.
But this is not the case at all. There's only one castle where that happened. That was Azuchi Castle. Are you familiar with Oda Nobunaga?
No, I'm not.
Oh, my God. Oda Nobunaga, he basically set Japan on a path of unity from the mid-1500s. Okay. And he built some massive, gorgeous, over-the-top castle on the east side of Biwa Lake, okay, near Kyoto. And he was the only one, really, who lived in the tower of a castle.
And everybody else lived where?
They lived in the castle grounds, so in a palace in the castle grounds is basically it.
Okay, so he lived up in the tower?
Yeah, he was like the only guy who lived in a castle. Yes, that's right.
Oh, okay, okay. And you know, like many typically English castles, when they had like a fight or a war or something like that, the whole village would go into the castle. Is that the same in Japan?
Oh, that's a good question.
You know, like the English castles, if you look at them, they're quite well fortified for sieges, and the whole village would go in there and basically the enemy would hang out outside and wait till their food ran out.
Yeah, I don't believe... I'm really not familiar with the life of... You know, daily life, etc. I mean, my interest really is what remains, what we can see today as a tourist.
Right.
I'm really not up on those details.
Okay, no worries.
Yeah.
What remains today? Like, you know, one thing that when I first visited Japan and I went down to Kyoto to look at all the temples and castles and whatnot, and I got to say, I was actually a little bit disappointed because many of these castles that I saw, as it turned out, I found out later, were actually rebuilt. And at the time I was looking at them, I kind of thought, you know, this thing looks rather new and it looks rather clean.
Yeah.
And I thought maybe that's just the Japanese thing of keeping everything new and clean. But, you know, when you kind of expect to see this old 15th century castle, I expect it to be kind of run down and feel like an old castle.
Absolutely. There are a couple of factors that make castles appear new. And the major one is only 12 castles survived the Edo period, survived to the modern age, with their main tower intact.
Only 12?
Wow. Only 12. And, you know, these are highly regarded and people go nuts over these 12. But in the 1960s onward, Japan went crazy for concrete castles. And they built, you know, another dozen or two dozen. And, you know, they look... I mean, they're sort of eyesores today, right? You go inside and it's just like a museum, a modern museum.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, that is very disappointing. And to be honest, I refuse to enter Osaka Castle for that reason. I mean, I just want to see it from the outside. It's good enough for me.
Right.
One other reason why some castles can look quite new and concrete-ish is, you know, this white plaster. You've seen the white plaster walls?
Yeah, yeah.
So when they apply that, they're sort of... you know, it's like toothpaste, I guess, but, you know, it's sort of smoothed on and contoured. And there are many towers that have these sort of wavy, contoured, smooth facades, you know, and you think, that's got to be concrete.
Right.
But actually, they're not all concrete.
No?
That look like concrete.
Right. What are they made out of?
Oh, so they have like a bamboo framework, and then they tie some string around the bamboo, and then they... apply layers of mud and then layers of white plaster.
Oh, okay.
But this white plaster suspiciously looks like concrete.
Right. Okay.
In the finished product.
Right.
So it's possible to be confused.
So you said that in the 1960s, Japan went crazy rebuilding these castles. Do you mean like they were rebuilding castles that had been destroyed, or they were just building new castles because they knew it'd be a good tourist attraction?
Good question. Absolutely for the tourist dollar.
Really? So it's, some of these castles that are being built don't really have any historic significance?
Oh, you know, I guess to their credit, they made efforts to make them as accurate as possible externally.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, Hiroshima Castle, Okayama Castle, Nagoya Castle, you know, they took photographs and before, yeah?
Right.
And then they made you know, the rebuilt castle to look just as it did.
Oh, okay.
But when you enter that castle, it's clearly a concrete building with concrete stairs and elevators and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
There are some cases where they have just built anything. They've disregarded the original designs, and they've made a modern concrete castle that looks better. It's more stylish than what originally was there.
Right. Are these new castles, are they built on grounds that originally had a castle?
Oh, okay, I'm with you. 99% yes.
Okay, you know, so at one point in time, this area did have a castle, and they just decided to rebuild it.
Absolutely. Okay. You know, World War II, people blame World War II bombing for the loss of many castles, but which is not true. But yeah, the towns, the cities who lost their towers, you know, they were sort of, you know, devastated. Right. So the towns themselves wanted to see these symbols back up, yeah?
Right, okay.
So then they would build them in concrete. There are some cases where new castles have sprung out of nowhere. Those places I've really avoided.
Right.
But there are two or three that come to mind, but I won't drop their names. But yeah, there is the odd castle that has sprung out of nowhere.
Just kind of as a close to the highway and close to the tourists, I guess, eh?
Yeah, I mean, it could even be a hotel. I mean, I think there's a castle near Tokyo, maybe Kanagawa, maybe, where, it looks like a castle, but it's a hotel.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. There's quite a few of those around.
And of the castles, the original ones that, you know, haven't been reconditioned, let's say, what state are they in? Are people allowed to go visit them?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is the great thing about castles in Japan. When there is an original building or a building that was built in the Edo period,
right.
i.e. before 1868, the Japanese government goes to great lengths to preserve them, and several are national treasures. Himeji Castle is, I guess, a prime example. National treasures or important cultural properties. Yeah, absolutely. They're not privately owned. They're maintained and, you know, kept for future generations.
Okay. And what's one of the most famous castles in Japan?
Oh, I will point to Himeji Castle again. I mean, it just is the most complete castle. You know, it has kept its main tower. It's kept many, many turrets and gates, and it really is a stunning example of a castle. If you look at, I guess, you know, arguably more famous castles, Nagoya, Osaka. Lots of stonework remains, but most of the buildings have been lost.
Okay. One thing I find interesting about your website and is your photos that you have of the ruins.
Oh, yes.
Remnants, yes. I guess, of old castles.
Yes.
Kind of scattered throughout Japan.
If you look at castles with just stonework, or even just partial stonework, that's probably they probably make up the majority, I'd imagine.
Right.
And these are the ones I love, you know.
Right.
I mean, I don't want to see concrete. I don't want to see, you know, like you said before, when you visit a castle, you want to see age. You know, you want to see something overgrown. You want to see something a bit sort of rusty and worn. Yeah.
Right.
So you know, these are the places I love the best. Absolutely. And there's plenty from, I mean, every corner of Japan has got these old ruined castles with just stonework.
Yeah, absolutely. I really like that too. I remember a few years ago I was traveling through France and driving in the countryside, and I came across like these ruins of this old temple or castle or whatever it was at one point in time. And all the stonework was still there but crumbling, you know, and you could walk around it, and you could go up these stone steps, and it was just really fascinating to see this crumbling building that at one point was significant. And actually, I climbed up to the top of it, and looking down, there was this like village in the bottom of the valley. So yeah. I could imagine that at one point in time, maybe the lord or whoever, this was his home, and he overlooked this village. So I really like these kind of older ones that have a bit of history to it. And I remember seeing quite a few of them throughout Europe, and it was just really cool. You're just driving along, and all of a sudden, boom, it's right there on the side of the highway.
Yeah, absolutely. Very cool.
Which is your favorite castle to visit?
Oh, okay. Well, I might, you know, I mean, I love them all, but I'll go by region. So in Kyushu, the westernmost island, I would urge people to check out Kumamoto Castle. Originally built in the, 1300s or so, but the castle that there is now was built in the 1600s, and it's just a masterpiece. You know, it's got massive stone walls, and many buildings are original. It's just an absolute amazing thing to see.
And sorry, where is this castle?
That's Kumamoto Castle in Kyushu. Okay. So that's the westernmost island.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. The one that I'd recommend in Shikoku, are you familiar with the Shikoku?
No, where's that?
Okay, so there's the main island of Honshu, of course, and You're in Tokyo. Right. So if you head west past Osaka,
right,
all the way west to the very west, there's the island of Kyushu, and that's where I am, of course. But in between Kyushu and Osaka, there is a smaller island that sits just below Honshu, and that is Shikoku.
Okay.
And Shikoku is just an amazing place to visit. That is where most castles are that have retained their Edo period tower.
Oh, okay.
So of the 12 in Japan, 4 are in Shikoku. So if you know, if you're into Japanese castles or you want to be, that's a place you really have to visit.
Right. So for tourists who are coming here, maybe don't know the layout of Japan, you're on the island of Kyushu, which if you look on the map of Japan is like the bottom island, right?
Yes.
It's the bottom main big island.
Bottom west, yeah.
And then going up from there, going up towards Tokyo, then you have the island of Shikoku.
Yes.
And then Honshu is the big one with Tokyo and Osaka and all that kind of stuff.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the island of Shikoku has 4 of the original castles?
Yeah. Or castles that have retained their Edo period tower.
Okay.
So, I mean, it gets a bit complicated. You know, some castles have retained other sections, but people go nuts for this central tower.
Right.
So, you know, the keep. In Japanese, it's called Tenshu. Okay. The Tenshu. And in Shikoku, you've got Matsuyama Castle, which is just a spectacular castle to visit. I recommend everyone check it out. Another castle is Kochi Castle that has retained its tower. Another one is Marugame. And Uwajima. Uwajima. So Uwajima and Matsuyama both are on the west side of Shikoku.
Okay.
And Ehime Prefecture, I mean, just you got to check the place out. It's just great. There's a famous old onsen, beautiful scenery, you know, castles with original towers, and it is just everyone has to visit Ehime, please. Please
okay.
do.
Okay. And these castles, people can get to them? They're open to the public?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know of any castle that isn't. I mean, there is a castle, and it was in private ownership, but even then, it's open to the public.
And can you walk around these castles kind of on your own, or is there a tour guide that goes through?
Oh, absolutely open to the public. Some are, you know, I mean, this might sound a bit odd thing to say, but there are homeless people living in Japanese castles.
Wow.
You know, I mean, they're just stones in a park.
Okay.
To many Japanese people, right?
Right.
So, you know, it's not the Louvre. It's not Buckingham Palace, you know.
Right.
It's just rocks in a park. And when it comes to the old towers and stuff, yeah, I mean, they put some fences around some of them and they block entry to some, but
just because I'm really comparing my experience visiting the that famous castle in Germany, New Schwanstein Castle.
Okay, yeah, I'm not,
you know, the one that Walt Disney copied for Disneyland.
I got no idea, Anthony.
Oh, really? It's that very famous German one that looks like the Princess Castle.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm familiar with the Disney Castle.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the Walt Disney copied this German castle for that look.
Oh, yeah.
And it's called New Schwanstein Castle in Germany. It's like super, super famous.
Ah.
It's the most famous castle in Germany. If you do search for Castle Germany, pictures of it all over the web.
Yeah.
But when I went there, I mean, it was just like
lockdown.
No, it wasn't part sort of, but I mean, you just got like, you're just like, there's a lot of tourists there, and you're just kind of shuffled through really quickly on this route that you can't get out of, you know,
the old conveyor belt, yeah.
Right? So it's just like, here's this room, here's this room, here's some stuff, here's this and that, here's the you know, the gift shop, and get out.
Okay.
So I was a little bit disappointed that I thought we could kind of walk around and kind of feel like, oh, what it would have been like to be a knight back then, and you know, walk through the castle and all that, but you can't.
Okay. Well, I mean, Japanese castles, generally speaking, are much more, there's much more freedom. The sort of the rules are, in many castles, no photos, which I'm not a fan of. Right. But you know, you can walk free, walk around freely. It can get a bit conveyor beltish, and I would name Matsumoto Castle in Nagano Prefecture.
Right.
You know, that gets it's a national treasure. It gets bus loads of tourists, and it just turns into a conveyor belt. Right. You basically shuffle your way up to the top, where everyone sits down and exhausted, then you shuffle back down, you know.
Right.
But other than that, you know, you're pretty much free to walk around and retrace your steps and stand in one spot, you know, if you want.
Now, many tourists who come to Japan obviously visit Tokyo. And what are some castles around this area that you recommend they can go visit?
Edo Castle, which has taken on a different name. Now it's the Imperial Palace.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, that's just epic. And, you know, there's plenty of things to see and do there.
Right.
Around Tokyo, actually, there's just, there's nothing too major. You know, there's Odawara Castle, which is west. North, you've got Kawagoe, which has some old, it's called a palace, but it's just a wooden building, an administrative building.
Okay.
There's really not much. I mean, West Japan has got all the good stuff, you know. Okay. It's got all the big castles with stonework and, you know, awesome. East Japan, there's the odd big castle around, but there's lots of small stuff as well. So around Tokyo, the Imperial Palace, Odawara Castle.
So really, look, by judging on your map, it looks like a lot more stuff to see kind of down south and west.
Yeah, and to be completely honest, the reason for that is because of how far I can travel.
Right, okay.
I mean, I'm basically stuck in this corner. But, I mean, you know, as I said, I mean, all the good stuff's out this way.
Right.
Well, I mean, some people might not be happy with me saying that, but, you know, Kyushu, Shikoku, West Japan, you know, up to Osaka and Central Japan, lots of great stuff. In Northern Japan, castles didn't really have the big stonework, generally speaking.
Okay.
It was more earth mounds, ditches, that sort of thing.
Right.
So what remains and what is more impressive is the stonework, and generally West Japan.
I noticed on your website that many of these castles have these symbols or what look like crests attached to them. What's the significance of these?
Okay. So in the Edo period, Japan was governed by the central Tokugawa shogunate. And basically, they shuffled people around, you know. So, and sometimes quite frequently, they just told a clan to pick up all their stuff and travel down the road and set up shop there. And then with that vacant castle, someone else would come in. So these symbols refer to the heraldry of the family who resided there.
So, for example, one of these says, like, Ikeda clan. That would be the family that lived in this particular castle from 1617 to 1641.
Yes, okay. And then there would be, I'm not sure where you're looking exactly, but then below there would be a figure and koku.
Right.
And this refers to the income.
Oh, okay.
10,000 koku is quite a low income.
Right.
But then it would go up, you know, it goes up to hundreds of thousands or... generally speaking.
So this particular family had 65,000 koku. Well, they were doing all right.
Well, yeah. I mean, they also had to pay bills and, you know, undertake certain projects that the government told them to do. But, yeah, absolutely. 65,000, I mean, relatively
speaking. Where would that income come from?
It is just rice. I mean, the economy was based on rice production and rice was the these the income really.
Right.
That was the money.
And this period in Japan was when they were not trading with foreigners, right? So all their rice would have been sold inside Japan.
Yeah. So Japan did have a closed off country throughout most of the Edo period.
Right.
Aside from some places. but you know, generally speaking, a closed country, nothing significant coming in or leaving, absolutely.
So all the trade in rice was internal?
Absolutely.
Interesting that that rice allowed these guys to build these huge castles.
Yeah. And look, I mean, I've got to say, there are people who know way more than I do. I don't know anything about the economics of the Edo period. So I just want to say that right out loud now. But basically, koku refers to rice production and the rice yield. And that was what they valued their lands on.
What's the current condition of many of these castles? Are they being kept up by the government? I noticed that, I remember a few years ago reading an article that many of the castles in Europe are falling apart because even the governments can't afford to keep them up because they're so expensive to maintain. What's the status of the Japanese castles?
Things are great in Japan, you know. Cities, towns, prefectures, they want castles. They want tourists. It works. Kumamoto Castle in Kyushu, I mentioned before, they rebuilt the massive palace and it gets busloads of tourists. Tourist numbers are going through the roof. Nagoya is rebuilding a palace because it will attract tourists. So, you know, it's just great news. Castles are getting rebuilt regularly. Sections of castles are being rebuilt regularly. Castles are generally maintained,
right.
Even if there's no buildings, you know. Generally speaking, they maintain the grounds very, very well.
That's always good, dear. And I imagine there's the entrance fee at most of these castles?
Having said that, you know, there are castles you can just walk around freely, right. Because in the late 1800s, early 1900s, castles became public grounds.
Right.
So, you know, hence they are just free to walk around.
Right.
But at castles, yeah, you have to pay, average, or generally speaking, you know, 200 yen, 300 yen, up to, I guess, 500 yen or 600 yen. It's very reasonable.
Yeah, I really think that for many tourists who come to Japan, trying to get out of Tokyo and like the Tokyo, Kyoto, Osaka route.
Ah, yes.
Would really do a lot to enhance your experience here.
Yes.
You know, that's kind of a common route that many tourists take. You just hop on the train, you get off, and you kind of eat the noodles, and you see the Golden Temple, and then, you know, you just kind of follow this pattern.
Yeah.
Whereas if you could get out of that a little bit, there's so many interesting things to see.
Absolutely.
That aren't in the guidebooks.
Absolutely. And, you know, I guess if you're if your schedule is like a week in Japan, I guess you sort of have to see Mount Fuji, see the Golden Pavilion and do that typical stuff. But if you had some extra time,
right,
and some, you know, some sense of adventure, absolutely. You could hop on a train, you could end up somewhere strange, and you could just do some amazing stuff and see some amazing things.
That's great. Well, thank you for coming on the show. If people are interested in finding out more information about castles and setting up your own itinerary, I would highly recommend visiting JapaneseCastleExplorer.com and check out the interactive map. This is the most fun part for me because this map is extremely detailed. How many castles do you have on your map so far, do you know?
At the moment, there's about 140.
140, wow. And they got, you know, I love being able to click on them and seeing the pictures and the video and all that kind of stuff. It's almost like I'm almost there.
Oh, great. Thank you very much, Anthony. I appreciate your kind words, and I'm really glad that, you know, you like it, you know, and you can get some value out of it.
No worries. I hope that the audience or anyone who's visiting Japan will also be able to get value out of it as well.
As do I. Thank you.
Thanks again to Daniel for coming on the show. If you're interested in finding out more about Japanese castles, visit his website at JapaneseCastleExplorer.com and check out his map. It's got a really cool interactive map on his website. It's got a lot of photos, a lot of video, kind of gives you a good idea of what these castles are like. Don't forget, everyone, that the next 2 weeks there will not be a Tokyo podcast. I'll be enjoying the nice, warm, sunny weather in Thailand with cheap food and cheap massage and cheap everything. It'll be nice. It's nice to go from Japan to Thailand because everything gets a lot cheaper. Coming from Thailand to Japan is not so good on the pocketbook, but I am excited about going back to Thailand for a few weeks of holiday. So I will be on the air again on January 8th. Listen for that show. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Anthony Joe, and happy holidays.